RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. That's how the creation of light is described in Genesis 1. But as my guest today points out, first of all, there must have been darkness. And that is a starting point for his chosen discipline. Mark Major trained as an architect, but has spent most of his professional life as one of Britain's most innovative lighting designers. He has illuminated everything from opera houses, bridges and cathedrals, to airport terminals, public spaces and iconic buildings. Although lighting design is seemingly a new creative discipline, Mark Major has another view and enthusiastically points out that it is much, much older than we think, as you'll discover in this interview. And he also acknowledges that still one of the most inspiring lighting experiences is the night sky, something very difficult to compete with. So join me now in an illuminating conversation with Mark Major, recorded in London's Clerkenwell.
I gather as a teenager you wanted to be a fine artist, but you were dissuaded from going to art school. Is that true?
Yes, I really always have deep down wanted to be a painter. And so I suppose I would say I'm a frustrated painter. In fact, I do still occasionally paint, but with decreasing frequency, unfortunately, maybe later in life I'll get back to it. I went to a very traditional private school, and they seemed to feel that sort of professions were the thing. So architecture just about sort of scraped by as a profession. Guess I could have had another life being a failed painter.
Let's talk a little bit about your background. Where were you born?
I was born in Worthing, Sussex, by the sea. I initially grew up there. And then to cut a long story short, due to sort of various machinations within my family, my mother and I found ourselves on our own. And when I was about seven, she remarried and took my stepfather's name. So he's very much my father. We moved to Bahrain. And I then grew up in the Gulf and had a rather interesting childhood. I was at a British council school. Oh. And it was all terribly colonial in Bahrain in those days. And then when I was about 10, I sort of, that all ran out of steam. I would have had to have gone to an international school and come under more of an American education system. Yeah. And they felt that it would be better to sort of send me home.
So what was that school life like? You came back here to go to a boarding school, presumably.
Yeah, I came.
From Bahrain, so yeah, and they stayed behind and you came here.
And then I would go out to visit them during the holidays, and I would get on be taken to Heathrow as an unaccompanied minor.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
And put a label put on me, and then I go on a BOAC VC10.
Those are the days.
Showing my age now. They sort of toured around, so they moved from country to country.
What did your stepfather do then?
He's a communications engineer. I mean, he worked in the vanguard of spreading telephones all over the Gulf.
Back at school here, when did the kind of creative side of you kick in?
Yes, I'd always been very keen on drawing as long as I can remember. But I was fortunate that the school that I went to, Hurstpier Point College, it was just north of Brighton. Whilst being a very traditional school and, guiding me towards a more professional education and slightly away from fine art, it did have a very good art department. And I was very fortunate that I had two teachers in my time there, Jonathan Howlett and another called Norman Rector. Norman was a painter who'd studied under John Piper. They had a very good art department and they were very encouraging. They also had an incredibly active school theatre, particularly as I got older, because I moved through the school between pretty much the age of, so say, 10 to the age of pretty much 18. Once I got to sort of 14 or 15, I became very engaged with the school theatre. And a small group of us would spend a lot of time designing and painting scenery.
You were not on the lighting rig then?
No, curiously, the amazing thing is I wasn't on the lighting rig. I had a great friend called David Milling, who I've lost touch with, who went on to work for the National Theatre.
After leaving at 18, presumably, went on to art college?
Did you do
a foundation?
No, I didn't do a foundation. I went straight into architecture school at, well, what is now the University of Brighton. Yes. But was then Brighton Polytechnic. I'm always slightly disappointed that it became a university. I was actually teaching there at the point that it became a university. But when I went there as a polytechnic, I think we were all kind of quite proud that it was a polytechnic, and it had a very sort of different bias from the universities. So I did my degree there, and it was quite technical, but I don't think that did me any great harm. I think I came away from there not only sort of with a number of creative skills, but I also came away sort of vaguely knowing a bit about construction and how buildings went together and understanding the principles of structure. It was a very good all-round education for an architect to receive.
And from there, you did your postgraduate up in Edinburgh.
Yes, I did, yeah, Edinburgh University.
Which was obviously going to be, that's where things started to come together for you.
Yes, I mean, Edinburgh and Brighton were like sort of chalk and cheese. I mean, Edinburgh, when I arrived there, was a very theoretical school of architecture. It had been, its head was a well-known architect called Izzy Metstein, who was one half of a partnership with Andy McMillan in a firm called Gillespie Kidd & Coyer, who were really one of the great Scottish modernist firms. Did some very seminal buildings like Cardross up in Scotland, and we were taught in a very sort of specific way. I mean, crits were very harsh, and it was a school in which you sort of, if you couldn't defend yourself from criticism, then you would sort of collapse.
You'd
really
die.
Yeah. And which was, for me coming from Brighton, a real eye-opener. But it opened my eyes to a lot of things in a way that Brighton hadn't taught me.
Brighton was very practical.
Very practical.
The very fact that they critiqued heavily and you had to defend yourself was put you in very good stead, actually, because that's what you're going to get for the rest of your life. You've got to stand up for what you believe in.
Yeah, no, it was terrific. And I mean, you know, it didn't suit everybody. It probably, you know, moulded those that did survive it and went through it in a particular way. But I did feel in hindsight that it did sort of, in a way, prepare you very well for what was to come.
I read that while you were there, you discovered some people working with light.
I would love to say there's some great romantic tale to this where, you know, sort of literally I kind of, you know, woke up one morning, had this sort of revelation. But the truth is that I was quite disaffected in some ways with architecture. I would sort of go in phases of sort of, it was a sort of love-hate relationship where on one level I sort of, you know, loved it and sort of loved the study of it, but I found aspects of it creatively quite limiting. And I suppose I still,
in what respect limiting?
I just suppose that still in the background was this question in my mind, had I sort of, you know, done the right thing? Should I have gone into fine art? Should I have painted and not, you know, sort of, you know, it was when I was sitting through all of those, you know, sort of lessons on, you know, structures and sort of construction and everything, whilst I sort of entered into it with a spirit which I, you know, I was meant to, and sort of took it all on board, there were times when I sort of thought, you know, why am I doing this? You know,
because you were kind of, I suppose you were going into a profession that is massively complicated, involved with collaborating with a huge number of people, whereas on the fine art side, it's just you and your and your brain and a blank canvas or whatever it might be.
And I used to spend a lot of time at college producing quite elaborate presentations that were trying to be sort of rather beautiful to convey the architecture. So, you know, sometimes I would get criticism from my tutors about the fact that I was all about sort of graphics, if you see what I mean, and not enough about architecture.
All style and no substance.
Well, sometimes, yeah. But then I could at least make it stand up. And so I ran into a friend and I was sort of venting my spleen about what should I do over the summer months between my fourth year and fifth year, my first and second year of postgraduate studies, and that I didn't really fancy working for an architect over that summer. I'd done quite a lot of work for architects previously, you know, if only to earn money, particularly in Brighton. I learned a huge amount through some, you know, sort of working with various architects down there, very sort of pragmatic practitioners working in that city. And she said, well, listen, I've been doing a little bit of work, and but I've had to move on and do something else for these guys that I've met who do lighting design. And I said, well, you know, well, what's that? And she said, well, it's lighting design for architecture. You know, they sort of, you know, come up with lighting solutions for buildings. And, you know, I'd never really kind of come across this. And she said, but they're great people and they're really good fun. She gave me the details of the man who was later to become my creative partner, Jonathan Spears.
So this would have been the lighting design partnership.
Yeah. That's right, yes. And Jonathan was had a really sort of remarkable early career, in the sense that he formed this lighting practice with a man called Andre Tammers, a theatre lighting designer. Jonathan came out of architecture, and they formed a lighting design partnership not really very long after he'd left college. I mean, he was only a few years ahead of me at Heriot-Watt, and I didn't know him at that time, but he had literally sort of finished his diploma, qualified quite quickly, and then gone straight into lighting in this partnership with Andre. And within a very short space of time, they'd set up Lighting Design Partnership, offering independent fee-paid lighting design services to a very limited number of clients that they managed to cobble together.
Because it was very new. I think in America it was probably a little more ahead, but
yes,
here
it was
just not.
It was, well, it was perceived as very new. I mean, later in life, I've obviously found out that it wasn't as new as we think it all is. Certainly back in the mid-1980s was something quite unknown. There were very few people, certainly in the United Kingdom, offering a sort of a proper professional service in that field.
So you had a lighting design partnership. You joined on a part-time basis, or
yeah? I mean, I went in initially.
Really,
what is the classic story? I went and met them, and we all got on. And they had just completed what was to become their first published project, which was a project in Oslo for the new Sheraton Hotel. Quite an unusual design. It had an atrium at its heart. It was a very postmodern building. I say that almost like I'm sounding disdainful about postmodernism, but it had an atrium at the heart, and Jonathan conceived of this design where the lighting would, particularly in the winter months, change very, very, very slowly over hours. So that, you know, let's say you left the building midday, you come back into the atrium at 6 o'clock in the evening, you think, oh, this feels different. But what you wouldn't be able to put your finger on, given it had been dark outside all the time, was that the lighting had changed.
What the
intensity, the sort of the shadow play. And really, it was quite an advanced concept for its time. And in fact, he almost working with a company called Electrosonic at the time, they almost had to invent a control system in order to enable all of this to happen.
So it was on some time control.
It was taking the principles of theatre lighting controls, but then automating them. And so it was a groundbreaking project. And there was an article that they were offered in a magazine that was floating around at the time called Designer's Journal. And they needed someone with some graphic skills to draw up lots of pictograms and diagrams and post-rationalized drawings, as you do for these magazines, to illustrate this thing. So they said, well, you know, we've got about a week of work, so will you draw this? So that's all I went in. And then, of course, something else came along, and they said, well, just hang on for another week. And then gradually the summer went by, and I became more and more involved, to the point that by the time my second diploma year had finished, they were back to me saying, look, things have expanded rapidly over the last sort of few months. They had a request from Richard Rogers, partnership at the time, to work on a project in at Billingsgate. And they'd opened a small office in London at that time. And they said, listen, do you want to just have a job in our London office and sort of go down there? And actually, we quite welcome that with you, as there's no architect working there at the moment. And we quite like to have somebody with an architectural background within that office. Worked very intensely, and they grew to be a really large firm. I mean, bearing in mind that, you know, I'd only been with them for a relatively short period. And when I met them, there were only three of them. They were up to about mid-20s in terms of size by the time I left them in, I think it was 1988. I just decided it was time to go back into architecture and qualify. I felt, having done this five-year course and given up all of these things, I might as well sort of, you know, finish off properly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And actually, I'm very pleased that I did. I went to work for a very, very noble firm of modernist architects called Howell Killick, Partridge and Amis, and they're a very well respected firm. Did a whole lot of sort of Oxford and Cambridge collegiate work, and produced some really groundbreaking buildings. I mean, they came out of that whole era of Leslie Martin and the LCC and mm-hmm. that sort of quite socially driven architecture. And I worked there for them for, I suppose, the best part of a couple of years whilst I got my qualifications. And I learned a tremendous amount from them.
So how long were you there for?
I think probably about 2 years.
You became an architect. You got all credentials. But you decided not to pursue architecture.
Well,
really.
It's not quite as clean as that. What happened was that just having qualified, Brighton got in touch with me and offered me a part-time job. Go in and they'd, you know, tutor a year on a sort of, you know, a Tuesday and a Thursday, and then they'd give you some money for it. I mean, yeah. It was pretty basic arrangement. And I had a former tutor who became a friend who had been teaching there for a long time, who had decided to, in the interests of his practice, move on. And the head of the school felt that I would be a suitable replacement in the first year for him. And that was largely, if I'm honest, because I was regarded as having very strong drawing skills, and we're still talking about the era of manual drafting. And I had strong drawing skills. I sort of had the basis of an ability to teach a sort of mini foundation course, and they thought I would be a good replacement. And so I really, really wanted to teach. In the background, had always had a very, very small diet of kind of private work that I used to sort of do. It would range from perspectives for people, small extensions to buildings.
So drawing up plans and getting permission.
Yeah, anything really, yeah, just yeah, to yeah. eat. So I had this sort of other sort of kind of vague body of work in the background. I used to do quite a lot of competitions, architectural competitions as
so
well.
So what, you would have been 24-ish, that sort of age?
Yeah, I could see the possibility that if I could earn enough from my teaching, just 2 days a week, then I might be able to find, with the combination of the lighting skills, which I'd picked up at LDP. So through the practice and through just the fact I continued to educate myself about lighting, because I hadn't had any formal lighting education. I mean, the only lighting education you would get was through practice or what you could learn.
Because it wasn't taught, I guess.
Not really. I mean, it was taught in architecture school over a few lectures.
But in a very basic way.
So I was very determined during that period to teach myself as much as I could.
Where did you draw your influences from?
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting question. I mean, there was relatively little information about. And in a funny sort of way, when there's relatively little information about, what you can do is sort of grab all of it. And, you know, I think now we have so much choice. You know, sometimes it's difficult to know what to kind of start with. But then there were so few areas that you could go to that, you know, in a way you grab them all. So I would literally sort of grab everything I could, read about it. And I think what helped me, and it was a bit like the blind leading the blind, is once I started at Brighton, when I started teaching at Brighton, the course was both a School of Architecture and a School of Interior Design. And they grabbed onto the fact that I had this extra dimension combo of architecture and light. And they immediately said, well, would I teach lighting design? And I said, well, not really. I didn't feel confident in those days that I really knew enough about what I was doing. I mean, I think it was quite interesting. I'm reflecting what other lighting designers of that era felt. But because we were all self-taught, I think we were acutely aware at the time of our sort of potential lack of knowledge, if that makes some sense.
Yeah, it does, yes.
So any of us that had come through an architectural education, what we knew was about architecture. We understood the relationship between light and architecture very well, and we could see the potential of this sort of relationship between, say, daylight, sunlight and artificial light, and the way they sort of complemented and supplemented each other. But when it came, and I think, you know, we could all teach ourselves the technology of lighting quite easily. You know, this lamp is this lamp does that, this has so many thousand hours life, you know, this goes in this fitting. You know, that was quite easy. But there was always, I think, all of us in practice at that time were very conscious in a way that we were selling an expertise or saying, we do this. But in the background, we still had a lot to learn. I think we all knew that.
So you wouldn't be at that point talking about the emotional dimension of light?
No, we did.
You did.
And you know, and some of that was intuitive. But I think we all just rapidly educated and supported. It was almost like we intuitively knew what we were doing and we had a sort of feel and a passion for it. But we then sort of supplemented that in the background with educating ourselves very rapidly about all aspects of light and lighting design,
mm-hmm.
because it was almost like you had this insatiable hunger to sort of know about this subject that was, you were more expert than the next person,
yeah.
but you didn't still feel expert enough. And so you sort of felt that you constantly had to sort of compensate for that by making sure that,
I guess,
you know,
because it was this sort of new frontier territory,
yeah.
even though, as you said earlier, it goes back longer than maybe yeah. we think. But generally, it was a new kind of frontier,
yeah,
and has rapidly developed in recent years. You know, beyond.
I mean, don't a lot of creative people, you know, in particular artists, sort of do that? Things that they do that later in life seem so predetermined and preordained, actually were based on a sort of an intuitive approach.
Often
backed by trial and error.
And often, often the case. Many of great things that have happened. Happened by accident. And then later there's this post-rationalization,
yeah.
normally from other people,
yeah.
art critics or whatever, explaining why it was done. Yeah. And then often the artist will say, well, actually, it didn't happen that way at all.
No, absolutely. And it made us, as I say, very sort of thirsty for, certainly made me very thirsty for knowledge. And then, so Brighton sort of twisted my arm quite heavily and said, listen, you know more than the rest of us. So, you know, just whatever you teach will be better than nothing at all. Which I thought, yes, but as long as it's right.
Yeah. So let's sort of wind on a little. When did you decide to transfer totally over to lighting
yeah.
and really get into that trap?
So there I was toddling along with a bit of part, having left architecture, a bit of part-time teaching, a bit of architecture, a bit of lighting. I must confess, even a bit of what I call graphics, not what you would call graphics, but I call graphics. It was this sort of creative sort of mix of stuff that I would that I would do, and I found out by pure accident, because Jonathan and I had sort of kept in touch on and off, you know, Christmas cards and sort of, you know, the occasional telephone call, and I rang LDP one day to have a chat with him about something. I think I rang him up to take the mickey out of him about a photograph that had appeared in a magazine in which he was wearing a slightly dodgy cardigan, and they said, well, he's left. And I said, what, left for the day? And they said, no, he's left. And I said, what do you mean he left? He's, you know, one of the principals. He's gone off on his own, which I was rather amazed by.
So this would have been the 90s, the early 90s.
It was about 92,
yeah.
I think. And in fact, he'd gone off on holiday to recover from what I think for him was quite a sort of traumatic period. And I spoke to him when he got back, and I said, he explained everything that had gone on. And he said, yes, I've set myself up, you know, on my own. He had one chap with him, a chap called Alan Mitchell. And was starting again this practice called Jonathan Spears and Associates. And I had my own small company by that stage. I was employing a kind of couple of students, you know, to help me. I had enough work for that. And so we discussed over a very short, and I was working from home, which I kind of hated. I just didn't like the mix of working from, you know, being sort of, you know, kind of yeah. part, you know, at home trying to work. I couldn't kind of concentrate. So we agreed that we would form a sort of loose association, because he needed somebody in London in terms of how to sort of get projects moving. He had a very big, you know, good client base.
So when you say in London, where was he?
Well, he was in Edinburgh.
Yes.
He lived and worked
course,
in Edinburgh.
Of course.
And but nonetheless, he was had always been very clear. I mean, even in the days when I was with him at LDP, that London was, you know, you had to have an office in London. So it suited him to have somebody who he trusted. You know, we'd worked together. We were great friends. At the end of a phone, and to be able to say, here's a sort of an address, and to have him his practice, his small and burgeoning practice. Represented properly in London.
Right.
It suited me to have somebody I could share an office with in London and have a reason and a way to get out of working from home. And we took two rooms at the top of a building in Museum Street above, I think it was Ulysses Bookshop. And we rented these two rooms. Within a very short space of time, the workload had grown for him and for me to the degree that we sat down and said, listen, we need to sort of formalise this in some way. This sort of loose working association is great, but it's all going a bit quicker for both of us than we imagined it had. You know, and I had quite a lot of lighting work as well. And so we formed Spears and Major.
That was in 1992.
Yeah, I mean, and so we had Spears and Major in London, and then there was still Jonathan Spears and Associates in Edinburgh, and we had to have this sort of group practice arrangement. So we formed something called the Lighting Architects Group, because that's what we called ourselves to, in a way, sort of, it was what we were. And because we could, because obviously the term architect is a protected title, and because we were both qualified architects and yes. had that sort of background, we felt that we wanted to continue expressing the fact that we were architects that worked with light. And that changed later, as I will explain, but nonetheless it was a very important thing to us. So we formed the Lighting Architect Group as the sort of banner under which these two practices could operate. And we worked like that right the way up until 2002.
And then what happened?
And then we decided that it was getting complicated again in terms of the market. You know, we'd done a lot of really quite interesting projects by then, things like the Millennium Dome and, some fairly sort of serious stuff.
Yeah.
And Jonathan had done the Burj Arab Tower in Dubai. Mm. And there was a sort of muddle beginning to be created in terms of, just the market perception of, so hang on a second, was that JSA that did that, or was that Spears and Major that did that? And why are there these two companies, and how does that all work, if you see what I mean?
So did they operate as separate financial entities?
Yes, they did. Yes, yeah.
There and you had an interest in the Spears Major side.
I had an interest in Spears and Major, and I was a sort of consultant to JSA, and we had a very equitable and fair arrangement about the sort of the way in which it was all set up. But as I say, it kind of got complicated. We were sort of doing three things, Lighting Architects Group, JSA, Spears and Major, and we said, look, listen, let's just kind of merge what became in 2002 Spears and Major Associates. And it allowed us to sort of, in a way, formalize, invite a couple of people in to become associates, proper associates. And there were associates within JSA, and there was an associate at that point within Spears and Major, but it just made everything better. And I'd always sort of said to John that I felt if we did that, we would really reap the benefits of sort of rationalizing everything and sort of becoming just one identity. I think his nervousness, and he wouldn't mind me saying this, was I think because he had been through one partnership that had foundered at LDP.
That original partnership had not lasted as long as the one that you...
No, I mean, it sort of, unfortunately, and I was very fond of LDP, subsequently, it did, carry on, but then it sort of bit by bit, drifted. And
let's talk a little bit about project. I'd like you to explain how you go about creating lighting for a project. I've looked through your list of projects and, interestingly, been responsible for a number of your sort of major religious buildings.
Yes.
And for me, actually thinking about it, going into churches, as an altar boy when I was young, lights are very important things, mostly candlelight,
yep.
admittedly, but it creates this kind of atmosphere, this dimension, yep. that's very, very part of the religious kind of emotional aspect. So you've got St. Paul's Cathedral,
yep.
including the inner dome, which I've seen photographs, yep. which is absolutely spectacular. You've got the Grand Mosque in Abu Dhabi,
yeah.
And you also had the Canterbury Cathedral as well.
Yeah, well, we're still working on Canterbury Cathedral. I always say that, cathedral work takes a long time because it took hundreds of years to build. So, a decade to light is nothing.
So let's talk just a little bit about, for example, St. Paul's.
Yeah.
Which must have been a lovely job to be asked to do, because it's like, such a wonderful building.
Yes, I mean, it's probably the job that gave me the most sleepless nights, but only sleepless nights in so far that there was a sort of huge weight of responsibility that one felt that, you had to kind of get this really right, be unforgivable, not to produce your absolute best in a building of that quality. And it's not that we don't feel that about, working on other contemporary, you feel that about every job, but somehow there was a sort of weight of expectation with such an iconic historic building. And we won the job. We were interviewed for it. And I understand we won the job because we were the only firm who were being interviewed that said we'd never worked on a cathedral before and we had no idea how to light one.
It's great confidence.
And but we had worked on a number of major public buildings, particularly at that time, the Dome.
Yes.
That were unbelievably challenging, that were sort of one-offs, and at the time one of the largest sort of single span surface areas to illuminate on the planet. And therefore, whilst we'd never done a cathedral before or anything of that sort of scale, we were supremely confident that we would figure out how to do it. We didn't say that flippantly. We were just being incredibly honest. And what we did do is take the cathedral through the processes that by which we design, from a research base. We look at the problem. We talk about it with you. We sort of, you know, we analyze the problem. We come up with solutions for it. And it's not just about sort of embellishing architecture. And I think we probably found that we said all the right thing. We weren't sort of, you know, we were just sort of being brutally honest about the... We almost wanted, and I think we're still like this with clients, we want to be very clear with clients as to, if you have limitations, what those limitations are. You want to manage expectation. So I think I sometimes, you know, we have to have the, all have as designers have the guile to, and the confidence to say, I can do that, you know, and I want to do that, and I'd love to do that, and it's a challenge I've never faced before. But I've always had this thing, if you're only as good as your experience then sort of limits you, you know, and we see that in a number of lighting designers who are fantastic at doing hotels. And so all they ever do is hotels. You know, they're only going to ever do an airport. If somewhere somebody gives them the opportunity to do an airport, or they persuade somebody that actually, even though they spend all of their time doing hotels, they make a great job of an airport, because it's about people and it's about hospitality and it's about sort of, you know, kind of, you know, there are parallels obviously between the illumination of one building type and another. So at St Paul's we started.
How do you? What I'd be interested in is how do you? Okay, I'm the client.
I'm the dean,
and you know we have this chat. How do you demonstrate to me, which actually will obviously at the end of the day involve a big rig, and you can't just say, well, we'll just bring the rig in and show you what it's going to actually look like, because it would be hugely expensive to do that. So how do you go about, do you just light a small area and say, think about this magnified by?
No, we start with developing a concept, and obviously we illustrate that concept.
How do you illustrate it? I mean,
we use all sorts of Photoshop presentation. I've always said that, you know, lighting is very, very difficult to communicate. And so what we have to do is to use multiple tools to do that. So one tool is words. It's sort of developing a language by which to, you know, so I can say to you, it glistens, you know, that we're going to create something that glistens. We all have a different perspective as to what glisten might mean. But nonetheless, it's a sort of word that evokes a sort of, you know, an effect. So I think we're very good with lighting language. And we've developed that over the years. And, you know, the sort of words like sparkle and twinkle, you know, make obvious things, but equal, you know, using words like sort of diffuse or focused, you see what I mean? They all imply a certain sort of talking about sharp shadows or soft shade and, you know. Yeah. So we use words, we use sketches to sort of very quickly communicate ideas about where we might place light and the direction of the light and the casting of shadows. We then use sort of visuals, which are a bit more elaborate. But they're not sort of Photoshop. They're not kind of trying to be photographs of the finished scheme. In fact, the one thing still as a practice, despite all of the technology and the software that now exists, we advocate very strongly to our clients that we should not be trying to create photorealistic images of the lighting, because it will never be like that.
Which is interesting, because most architectural firms produce very elaborate animated, you know, fly-throughs and God knows what else. Yeah.
But really, to properly, in software, emulate the precise effect of light, you have had to have made every last decision about, you know, the fact that you put in a red flooring will produce a pink cast on the ceiling.
Yes, yes, yes.
So, you know, unless you, and generally speaking, when you're involved in the design of a building, you know, all of those decisions haven't been made, and by the time they've made, it's too late anyway.
Yeah.
So to a certain extent, you know, a lot of these incredible renderings that you see produced through lighting models are often post-justified. They're sort of done after the event by the companies that sell the software.
Right. Oh, really?
But nonetheless, you know, we do Photoshop work, and we have some very skilled people that work in our studio who have a real eye for lighting, and a much better eye than, I would say, the visualizers who do CGIs for marketing. You know, a marketing CGI is trying to do something other than what a lighting CGI is trying to do. A lighting CGI is trying to, you know, sort of actually show what it would be like and feel. Marketing CGI is trying to sort of sell it in a certain certain way. So quite often the lighting is quite deceptive. So we use photographs a lot of things that are similar. So we say, look, you know, we're going to uplight a tree and it will look a bit like that.
Okay.
So we've got a vast library of, you know, different sort of, you know, kind of
lit effects. So they would be placed within the document to show.
But ultimately we do mock-ups, and St Paul's actually, we did a very large mock-up. We mocked up a quarter of the lighting of the dome, and we mocked up the whole of the south transept.
Wow.
And we did that, but we'd gone a long way down the line at that point. You know, we'd seen various committees, we talked to English Heritage, We talked to the Cathedral Fabric Commission of England. We've gone through a whole series of presentations. And so for us, communicating our ideas about lighting is about sort of slowly building from an initial concept or strategic idea about the project through a whole series of layers of information, such that you sort of take the client with you until you arrive at a mock-up, hopefully, where you can show them a section of how it would be like, or a key, or some key details, whereby then their imagination and their understanding of the lighting scheme is sufficient that they get it.
Okay, well, let's go on about a project that appeared at Tate Modern in 2012, which was nothing to do with you, but I think it had a profound effect on people in terms of the effect of light, and that was the Olaf Ellison
Weather Project, yeah.
Weather Project, yes. Which I went along to, and I've never seen people react in such a fantastically joyful way. Yeah. I don't know if you remember it. People were lying down. They had this, I think what they used to call in the theatre, cracked oil to create this misty effect. And it was just, it was religious. It was like the coming of Christ or something. This is fantastic.
There are some great artists out there, like Olafur, obviously like James Turrell.
Yes.
The late Dan Flavin.
Yeah.
You know, these are all kind of artists that work with light. Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, that for me was a sort of an amazing project to witness. I mean, I loved it.
Well, I was thinking things that have moved me through my life through light. And one of the earliest, and maybe it's the same for you, I don't know, but going to a fairground. Fairground was an exciting place. Why was it was exciting because of lights, and there was an atmosphere created that was quite unique. So I think what you've just touched on, the connection between people and light, is almost like the connection between people and music. It has an emotional dimension.
I said earlier that the notion of, you know, what we do and the sort of connections that we had within lighting, it was something that perhaps was or lighting design, and the passion for lighting design was something earlier than perhaps we thought it, we all think it is. And something that I've spent my time studying in the background, studying is probably too strong a word for it. I enjoy history. And I have certainly spent some time sort of doing research into how people, and in particular architects, responded to the this amazing new medium, electric light, in the the turn of the 20th century. And there's quite a story there. You know, somebody needs to sort of write in great detail at some point. There's a very fine architectural historian called Dietrich Neumann, who's done some terrific work in that area, and another called Wolfgang Schivelbusch, who's written some fantastic stuff about the sort of the early days of industrialized light. There is quite a story there about how when electric light became widely available, people went kind of mad for it. And that thing you're saying about fairgrounds, I mean, you know, Luna Park at Coney Island in the early 1900s, if you went there, you know, imagine you were sort of, you know, a small kid from New York and you went to Luna Island, and it must have been unbelievable because it was filled with thousands of miniature lamps, coloured. You know, we all see black and white photographs, but it was coloured, as I understand it. And certainly the great sort of hotbed of all of this amazing lighting effects were all the world's fairs that took part,
of course,
place at that time. You know, things like the Chicago World's Fair had the most amazing demonstrations of electric lighting, you know, that were absolutely awesome.
In the early days of cinema, when they had premieres, they would use these massive lights to beams, you know, to excite the crowds. And also, coming a little bit further forward, the Nuremberg rallies used lighting in a pretty dramatic way.
It goes back even further than that. I'm not a historian. I may be picked up by somebody far more expert than I on saying this, but I read somewhere at some point that architects like Brunelleschi used to provide lighting, theatrical lighting, for mystery plays in the churches in Florence.
That would have been candlelight, of course.
Yeah. But what they used to do was take glass vessels of different sizes, and they would fill them with coloured liquids to make them into lenses.
How interesting, because there's a new Shakespeare theatre where the entire production is lit by candles, and they're in glass containers, yeah. and they lower the thing down onto yeah. the stage.
And they would use, reflectors to sort of push that. And, you know, they would create these primitive optical yeah. systems using candles.
And, of course, when one thinks of Caravaggio or Wright of Derby, they were all playing with light.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the Dutch, of course, they were all using light to... Yeah. capture an atmosphere.
So I think these sort of cross connections between the sort of use of artificial light for the creation of atmosphere and drama and meaning and symbol and, you know, all of the things that, you know, sort of in a way, you know, you just mentioned two of my favourite painters there, you know, Caravaggio and Joseph Wright of Derby. They, particularly Joseph Wright, he almost did the inverse of Caravaggio, didn't he? Where, Caravaggio was the light from above and yes. then, you know, Joseph Wright was the light from below.
Yes.
But they, it's something, again, talking about how we communicate with light. We often use paintings as being the means by which to sort of, you know, talk about atmosphere and how we might create atmosphere, about sort of ways in which to view that. So I think this story about light, this unwritten story or partially written story, I'm sure it's been written all over the place, you need to sort of gather it all together and, you know, into, but this story about light, the cross currents between architecture, theatre, the church, and I'm sure, you know, if you're sort of from another culture, you know, the same story goes in Islam or in Buddhism or the cross currents and art. And they've always been there.
I'd also be interested, because during the period of cave painting, they would take vessels with animal fat to illuminate.
yeah.
But clearly what they were doing and the effects they were creating and the animals on would have an effect in terms of how they're lit.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
So, I mean, there's a book there, clearly, that you need to produce.
Well, yeah, one day if I have the have the energy. But as I say, I just think those cross currents that we all enjoy now
yeah.
in the field of lighting and architecture and theatre and, you know, this wonderful, you know, rich mix and rich diet of there's always this fundamental belief that somehow this has been sort of invented recently. And I just think that probably we're a bit misguided in that, to believe that it has been invented recently.
True.
I think it's actually sort of been there with us.
I think it's the scale now is different. And I was, you know, reminded earlier today that just last week I was watching some live broadcasts from the space station, and they showed photographs in 2003 compared with today, major cities and how lighting has increased. They showed Abu Dhabi particularly, which is staggering. 2003, you know, general glow. Now there's this massive, and it brings me on to a topic which I'm sure you've been asked before, but, you know, there's this whole thing about wasted energy and all of that. How do you cope with those sort of criticisms? I mean, a lot of people are saying London now is overlit. Why don't we turn all the stuff off? Every time you look around, there's another building with a big sort of facade that's been illuminated. It looks wonderful, you know. Yeah. I mean, when I pass the National Theatre and see what they've done with the fly towers, I think it looks like a Rothko. It's just beautiful. But there is criticism.
You've touched upon a sort of an area or a subject that is very dear to me. I mean, as a designer, you're constantly looking for new challenges. And one of the things that goes back to my studies at Edinburgh, what Edinburgh was very, very good at, as well as being a great architecture school, it had a very strong perspective on urban design. You know, it actually had a sort of planning and urban design department as an integral part of the school. And you were encouraged to think big. You know, you sort of thought city scale as opposed to building scale. And I always sort of carried that with me. And right from early on, I mean, even in my LDP days, I was always interested in the notion of not just lighting individual spaces within buildings or lighting buildings, the inside and outside of individual projects, but I was taught as an architect to always think about the context within which you were designing something. And I saw lighting as being peculiarly acontextual in the way in which lighting designers approached it. You know, they'd light the project, but they very rarely think about what was around it. And I was very keen, or became very keen, on the what I suppose now we call urban lighting. At the time, I don't think anybody had quite defined it in that way. And have spent, you know, the last decade and a half, firstly in the background and then gradually professionally, exploring that area. And we have, as a practice, produced a number of strategic lighting plans for cities, then also large private developments, you know, such as King's Cross or the Greenwich Peninsula, and, you know, have gone on actually to sort of do some pretty major strategic lighting work, such that it's become such a mainstay within our practice that we now have a team that is dedicated to that specialist area of work. And it happens to be, you know, sort of one of my, you know, real areas of passion is exploring the lighting of public space, the spaces between buildings, and how we light our streets and public squares and parks. And it's led me into, you know, onto some great projects and some very interesting areas. And of course, that brings you into touch with those areas that you just mentioned, such as people's perception of energy use, actual energy use, problems of light pollution. You know, where are we going with all of this? And one of the parallels that I often draw, or I would say analogies is probably the better word, is to say, and it's very crude, is to say, just imagine electric light is here to stay. You know, we're not going to sort of turn the clocks back and go back to sort of pre-electric civilization where lighting technology limited what you could do after dark. Unless we have to, you know, because we run out of power, it's unlikely to happen. So whilst electric light is here to stay, since the early 1900s or even the sort of late 1800s, as I said earlier, we've sort of gone mad for it, and it's sort of was viewed as sort of cheap, almost free at source. I mean, it wasn't, but almost free at source, and very much taken for granted. I mean, if you walk into a room and it's dark, you look for the light switch and you turn it on. You just assume there's going to be a light switch and you assume there's going to be a light. If you turn the switch on and the light doesn't come on, then something's wrong. And we've got like that as a civilization. We just sort of assume, and in Africa, I know, street lighting, for instance, is seen as, the difference between, that's when progress has arrived in a sort of village or in a town in Africa. I mean, I also, as well as the Gulf, I lived in Africa for a short time. My parents worked in Africa for a short time, and I saw that happening. You know, the arrival of street lighting in a place was, you know, you've made it. Mm. You are now a proper town because you've got street lighting. So we shouldn't underestimate the importance and the value of light to people and the reasons we use it and need it. At the same time, like anything, you can have too much of a good thing, and its overuse is now leading to a number of problems. One of those is light pollution, where it's not just to do with light fittings throwing light up into the sky, just the sheer amount of light and the reflected light off even blacktop and off buildings, if you see what I mean, gathers in the sky and sort of illuminates the clouds and creates this pall over our urban environments that cuts out the view of the stars. And you could say, well, unless you're an astronomer, are you really bothered? And the answer is, well, you should be, because if you ever have the privilege of standing out under the Milky Way and experiencing what the night should really be on a cloudless evening, then we all know how fantastic that is. And that is just as important as having trees or grass or water, you know, natural stretches of water. You know, in a way, it's part of our landscape. Mm. Our visual landscape is the sky over your head at night.
Well, it is one of the greatest light shows. I live in the countryside, and there's no street lighting at all. Yeah. So I get those fantastic black skies with stars.
And what it also does is it reminds you, you live on a planet, and therefore you remember, in a way, how small and insignificant you are within the universal order of things. You have it enables you to have much bigger ideas about, you know, where you are in the universe and within space. I sort of think it's sort of part of it's part of man's nature to sort of have a relationship with the night sky. And it is tragic that there are children in cities all over the world who think there are only three stars in the sky or have never experienced the Milky Way. As cities get more and more lit, it's more and more difficult to kind of keep that light out of your windows. You know, short of sort of gaffer taping the blinds, you know, that light creeps through.
It does.
And certainly, you know, in central London, you know, I sort of stay during the week, obviously, in central London. And I stay in an apartment, and I live in the countryside at the weekends where, like you, it's totally dark. And it's fascinating because I cannot believe how much light there is outside all night long in central London. I mean, I kind of know it, and you could say, well, you know, maybe you're part of it, but we're not part of it. You know, we have always talked about less is more. You know, if we could turn down the volume a bit, then we wouldn't need to try so hard to sort of illuminate things. You know, if you've got a dark canvas against which to work, then actually you need to do very little in order to sort of pick out a building or a tree or a detail or whatever. So I think it's a very serious issue. And certainly this analogy I was coming to, sorry, I digressed, was that if we were all given a light bulb at birth, you know, let's say, I mean, it's a stupid analogy, but say, right, here you are, you know, you've been born, here's your light bulb for life. You're only going to get one. Even if we just did that, just on the basis of population growth over the next 50 years, there'll be a hell of a lot more light bulbs. We've got to really do something about this before we just, in a way, fill our entire world with light to a degree that we, you know, we cause immense and almost irreversible damage, not just to us and our nature, but also to, you know, ecosystems within cities, to, you know, bird populations, to, you know, all sorts of problems that sort of light pollution and over illumination causes. And the stupid thing is, it's so unnecessary and it's such a waste of energy.
I'm just going to wind on a little now. Sadly, you know, 2 years ago your partner Jonathan Spears died, which was at a very young age of 54, which
he was,
is
yes.
terrible. How did that affect you? Because obviously it's a major part of the partnership.
What, personally or in business terms?
Well, I think all around. I mean, you know, obviously he was a good friend and you could bounce off. And
I mean, personally, obviously had a huge effect on me on many different levels. I mean, firstly, I think none of us expect to die young. I know when you're in your 20s, you look at somebody who's in their mid-50s and think, well, you're not so young, mate. But, you know, 54 is awfully young to die. So comes as an awful shock when one of you, you know, we always had that sort of saying that you have within a practice about, you know, well, we better do this just in case one of us goes under a bus, that kind of, you know, the metaphorical bus.
Slightly jokey.
And obviously one of us did. So it had a huge personal effect on me, losing somebody who I was worked with for many, many years and was extremely close to. I mean, you know, we were a bit sort of, I suppose it was a bit more like a sort of relationship between brothers where, you know, not every moment in the relationship is good. You know, you have arguments and then you sort of have, you know, kind of incredibly sort of joyous and hilarious moments together. But we had a very close partnership, close working relationship, and you know, it was a very and remains in a way a testing time in that respect. In terms of the practice, it was rather fascinating, and I think it was very heartening for Jonathan because he was diagnosed with cancer in the back end of 2009 and was told that he didn't really have a very good prognosis, but he fought very hard, and in fact it was 2 years before the illness took him away from us. And during that time, he was able to see what happened to the practice. He had to retire in early 2010 very quickly, given his prognosis. Worked for a short while for the practice as a consultant. You know, we wanted him to remain involved, and he wanted to remain involved as long as he reasonably could. But as he reflected, you know, once you're out of the game, you kind of fall out of the game quite quickly.
It's fast moving.
It's very fast moving. And it was really sort of within a year he sort of decided to sort of pretty much step down altogether and spend just enjoy his time with his family and his friends, of which he had many friends. And Jonathan was able to witness the fact that we had built a practice that was strong enough to ride the problem of one of the founding partners or the principals, you know, going under a bus. And that was, I think, really comforting to him. We talked about it before he passed away, that he kind of said, he'd always say, oh, you know, I always had the confidence that, you know, it would be fine. But I think, or I know that deep down he was really proud, and, you know, it really helped him to see that the practice wasn't made of straw.
No.
By any stretch of imagination, that the brand was very strong, and that, you know, with you know, when he got ill, there were three directors in the practice. There was Jonathan, myself, and Keith Bradshaw was already a co-director working with us. And Keith and I obviously had to sort of pick up the practice and sort of, you know, on a very pragmatic level, you know, we were like, well, you know, is this going to work? I mean, you know, sort of, you know, you're taking out Jonathan out of the system. But the team responded fantastically around us. Our clients were great. And we also, you know, we didn't sort of advertise it, shout it from the rooftops that Jonathan was ill.
Yeah.
And it was incredible, you know. It just all adapted and life went on. And the practice, I think, in a funny sort of way, grew stronger. And you've got to remember that, you know, at that time in 2009, 2009, 2010, you know, workload wasn't great.
No.
Yeah, it wasn't the best of times. Mm. And so I think it was a really sort of fantastic thing that he saw that the practice would continue to go from strength to strength, mm. despite the loss. You know, the loss was palpable, but, you know, nonetheless, you know, as he would say, you know, life goes on, and it's, you know, his legacy could continue.
Sure.
through the practice.
Let's just bring it up to date a bit now. In terms of the practice now, and I know that it's, you know, you're expanding, you're about to move fairly soon.
Yep.
You also seem to have developed the idea of lighting branding or brand lighting. Mm-hmm. So, for example, your BBC Scotland building yep. is very much emphasising the brand of BBC Scotland.
Yeah,
so right. that now is something that is an additional aspect to what you do. I mean, branding is about the totality of an organization, its personality, everything about it, its tone of voice. Lighting has now been added into that.
Yeah.
That's a new area. And you're also, being an architect trained, you're obviously interested in physical objects, in making. And I know that you've been responsible for some street lighting and so forth. Is that something you're expanding?
Yes. Well, I said earlier that the term lighting architect was one that we used with some degree of pride over the developing years of the practice. But Jonathan, Keith and I had already decided prior to the news about Jonathan's illness to change things. And in fact, you know, we were on target for creating a new identity around the practice, dropping the associates and calling it, you know, Spears plus Major, Spears and Major, in a sort of much more branded way, and working around a title, dropping the lighting architects, and working around a title which was Designers Working with Light. And it's not suddenly that we thought that somehow architecture is inferior to design. We're not getting into that debate at all. It was a recognition that our work had changed. It wasn't all about architecture. It wasn't all about urbanism either, that we had sort of started doing a lot of work in other areas that was quite interesting, particularly related to the experience of people's brands after dark, you know. And that we also had built up an amazing expertise in sort of systems and products. And whilst we didn't want to become industrial designers or think we were sort of tame industrial designers, that there was some sort of potential there for us as practice to sort of focus on that particular area. And most importantly, we suddenly sort of, you know, almost woke up and realised that a large percentage of the people that were now working within the practice weren't architects anymore. You know, we had originally actually been largely drawn from architecture. But now we, you know, have people that came out of product design, people that came out of graphic design, people that come out of interior design, sort of all different areas, if you see what I mean. Mm. And it didn't, in a funny sort of way, calling ourselves lighting architects represent them very well. So we embarked upon this change. And I think, again, our sort of the perception of the practice and the type of work we do now is much more mixed. Mm. I'm not saying that change in identity and the sort of rebranding and everything brought that about, but I think it was a better expression of where we had got to. Mm. And certainly, you know, we very much enjoy working in all of these different fields. And we learnt that from sort of having the benefit of working on a wide range of different building projects initially. It's easier to explain that through an example. So one of the earliest projects that we did, large projects that we did, was Bluewater. And that's a retail project. And as an architect, you know, shopping centres are a bit of a dirty word. But for us, you know, it was an amazing opportunity in lighting terms to sort of do this sort of holistic vision for this massive new centre. And I think we did a pretty good job on it. And we certainly learned an enormous amount about retail through that project. We then were appointed to do Terminal 5 by BAA. And again, it was one of those classic moments where we said, well, we've never done an airport before, so we don't really know how we'll go about it, blah, 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 blah. And when we were appointed, we said, well, why did you appoint us? Because we've never done an airport before. And they said, because you did Bluewater. You know, BAA has a very strong retail bias. And we wanted we want the people who did Bluewater. We know how to park aeroplanes around a building and light an apron. We don't need you for that. What we needed you for was your sort of retail lighting expertise. And also the fact that, you know, we've got this great architect, Richard Rogers, doing this building, and, you know, you sort of worked with them before and you can, you know, sort of know how to illuminate their architecture. And so for us, it was a very big realization with that example and other examples beyond, where what we learn on one project, we bring to another. And you could say, oh, jack of all trades, master of none. But we do have a lot of areas, of expertise. We're only as good as what we've worked on. We know quite a lot about the church, you know, through working on cathedrals. And we know a lot about cities and sort of issues of standards of safety in the street, for instance.
I think it's clear that you're sort of trailblazing in certain areas and then harnessing all that information together, and it becomes another dimension that you can offer to a client.
Yeah.
Because it is, you know, it is such a relatively, even though we've talked about the history of it, it really is still quite a new area. I always end these interviews with the same question, so I'm going to ask you. And then, what advice would you give to a young budding designer who wanted to embrace your world of working with light?
I would say that it comes back to education. If they want to go into lighting design in the way in which we do lighting design, the first question they would ask us is, well, where can I go and be educated to do that? And the answer is, unfortunately, still, there's not many places you can go for a formal education in lighting. So what I would say is learn the basics, but not about lighting technology. That's an ever-moving feast anyway. You know, if you come to a practice like that, we can teach you about that. Learn the basics you need to be a really great designer. Learn about, you know, if you want to be an architectural lighting designer, learn about architecture. and have, you know, sort of in a way hone your skills in terms of everything from the way you observe the world to the ability to sketch, to conceive in three dimensions, to make things. You know, you have to sort of be a kind of polymath, I think, to deal with, to deal with light. Well, you have to do in any creative industry, actually, sort of have this very wide view of the world. And so what I would say to them is, before, if you have the time and if you can afford to do so, because, quite a lot of students and young designers are driven into a field or driven into an area by a need to eat. But if you have the time to do so, spend your time gathering a sort of skills base that you can sort of bring into lighting that is about everything.
So an eclectic view. I mean, I share your view that all of the creative disciplines, and that goes into theatre and all of those areas, I mean, not just theatre lighting, but, you know, acting, the whole physicality of that world. If you draw all those in, you'll be a far better individual and designer. There's no two ways about that.
So, you know, for instance, you know, I have a lot of friends who are architects and a lot of, you know, architects, very, very good architects that I'm lucky enough to work with. So, and, you know, trainers and architects have the greatest respect for architecture. But I think they're, and I understand, and I've been, you know, sort of exposed to architecture at a level where I really understand, you know, sort of how detailed that debate can become, you know, when you're talking architecture with a capital A and you see, you know, really high quality architects or very educated architects debating the finer points of architecture with each other. It's like any field or any discipline, it actually suddenly narrows down enormously. And I think to be a good lighting designer, you have to be incredibly broad. So that would be my advice.
I think that's very good advice. Mark Major, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike.